A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about couples and friendship. The specific scenario is when one partner moves into the other's existing social circle and ends up feeling like they never really chose their own friends. The deeper question is whether couples should maintain independent friendships, what the research actually says about how relationships handle external social ties, and, for someone who's gotten used to receiving friends rather than making them, where do you even start rebuilding that muscle? There's a lot here.
There really is. And the prompt lands on something that relationship researchers have been circling for years, but popular culture keeps getting wrong. This idea that a healthy couple does everything together. The data says the opposite.
Of course it does. The we blob.
The we blob. That's exactly the term some researchers use, couple identity fusion. And there's a really important longitudinal study out of the University of Arizona that tracked newlyweds over time and found that couples who maintained independent friendships reported higher marital satisfaction at the 5-year mark than couples whose social lives had fully merged. The mechanism they identified was interesting. It wasn't just about having space. Independent friendships reduced what they called relationship boredom.
That's a clinical term now.
And it's measurable. They looked at something called the couple boredom scale, actual validated instrument, and found that when both partners bring new stories, new perspectives, new energy into the relationship from outside, the relationship itself stays more interesting to both of them. You're not just rehashing the same shared experiences.
It's like intellectual cross-pollination. You go out, gather pollen from your separate social flowers, bring it back to the hive.
That's a very sloth way of putting it, but yes. And there's a flip side that's darker. Eli Finkel at Northwestern. He wrote a book called The All or Nothing Marriage. He argues that one of the reasons modern marriages feel so pressurized is that we've loaded everything onto the partner. Your spouse is supposed to be your best friend, your co-parent, your intellectual sparring partner, your emotional support system, your financial partner, and your primary source of social life. That's an impossible job description.
And if your partner is also your only real social outlet, you've just given one person a portfolio that would require a team of 6 in any other context.
Finkel's research shows that marriages where partners diversify their social and emotional needs across multiple relationships are more resilient. When one relationship hits a rough patch, the whole structure doesn't collapse.
Which brings us to the friend inheritance problem. Because the prompt isn't just asking whether separate friends are good, it's describing a specific dynamic where one person has effectively been absorbed into a pre-existing ecosystem.
I love that term, and it's incredibly common. I was looking at some research on what sociologists call network migration, when one partner joins the other's established social network. There's a really good study from the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships that looked at couples where one partner relocated for the relationship. They found that about 60% of the relocating partners reported feeling like their social life was borrowed rather than owned.
That's the word. You're a tenant in someone else's friendship structure. If the relationship ends, you lose not just the partner, but the entire social world.
That creates a really uncomfortable power dynamic that most couples don't talk about. The partner who brought the friends holds all the social capital. Even in a healthy relationship, that asymmetry is there.
The question becomes, how do you build your own social capital from scratch when you're already embedded in a system that provides a default social life? It's like trying to learn to cook when someone keeps handing you takeout menus.
The first thing I'd say is, the research on friendship formation in adulthood suggests you have to be intentional in a way that feels almost artificial at first. There's a sociologist named Rebecca Adams who studied how adult friendships form, and she identified 3 necessary conditions: proximity, repeated unplanned interactions, and a setting that encourages people to let their guard down. And that's why making friends after college is hard. Those conditions don't just happen anymore. You have to engineer them. The good news is, once you understand the formula, you can replicate it.
What does that look like, practically? For someone who's been in friend inheritance mode for years, and now wants to build something that's actually theirs.
The research points to a few things. One, regular, structured activities with the same group of people, not one-off meetups. A friend of mine who studies social networks told me about a paper that found it takes roughly 50 hours of contact to move from acquaintance to casual friend, and about 200 hours to become a close friend.
200 hours. That's a part-time job.
And that's why it's hard. But it's also why joining a recurring thing, a class, a sports league, a volunteer gig, a regular game night, works better than trying to meet people in an unstructured way. You're banking those hours automatically.
The advice isn't put yourself out there. It's put yourself in the same room with the same people every Tuesday for 6 months.
And there's a second piece that's more uncomfortable. You have to be the initiator. The research on friendship reciprocity shows a strong asymmetry. Most people think they initiate more than they actually do, and most people underestimate how receptive others are to being approached. There's a phenomenon called the liking gap, where people systematically underestimate how much others like them after a first interaction.
The person who's been passively receiving friends through their partner has probably also let their initiation muscle atrophy.
And the fix is awkward. You have to invite people to things, you have to send the text, you have to risk the rejection. But the data on the liking gap suggests the actual rejection rate is much lower than people fear.
Let me push on something. The prompt mentioned a feeling of having subscribed to a system where all socializing has to be collective. That's a specific complaint, not just that they don't have their own friends, but that the couple's social life has become a package deal. What does the research say about that dynamic?
There's a really interesting line of work on what's called dyadic withdrawal, the tendency of couples to pull back from individual friendships as they become more committed. It's been documented since the 1980s. But newer research distinguishes between healthy and unhealthy versions of it. The unhealthy version is when the couple starts operating as a social unit that can't be separated. Every invitation is a plus one. Every friendship is a couple friendship.
The fused entity problem.
And what happens is that individual friendships start to feel like they require justification. Why do you want to see them without me? Becomes a question that needs an answer.
Which is a terrible question. It presumes the default is togetherness, and the deviation needs a reason.
And the healthier framing is that individual friendships are the baseline, and couple socializing is one option among many, not the default.
How do you shift that? If you're already in a dynamic where everything is collective and the idea of doing something separately feels like a statement.
The clinical literature on this is pretty clear. You don't make it a big conversation about needing space because that frames it as a problem. Instead, you just start doing things. You join the Tuesday thing. You make a plan with a coworker. You normalize it through action rather than negotiation.
Because negotiating it implies it's something that requires permission.
And once it's normalized, the partner often feels relief too. The all-together, all-the-time model is exhausting for both people. Nobody actually wants to be someone's entire social world.
There's another layer here that the prompt didn't name, but I think is underneath it. The identity question. If you've been in someone else's social circle for years, you probably developed a version of yourself that exists in relation to them. You're Hannah's partner, or Ezra's dad, not just you.
That's a really important point, and it connects to something in the self-expansion literature. Arthur Aaron's work on self-expansion theory shows that close relationships expand your sense of self. You incorporate aspects of the other person into your identity. That's healthy. But if all your social contexts are filtered through the partner, you can lose track of which parts of your social self are actually yours.
Building independent friendships isn't just about having someone to grab coffee with. It's about recovering an identity that exists independently of the primary relationship.
And that's why it can feel existentially important even when the inherited friends are perfectly nice people. The issue isn't the quality of the friends, it's the agency.
The prompt said something like, "You might like the people, but still feel weird about it. That's the distinction."
Agency matters for well-being. There's a huge body of self-determination theory research showing that autonomy is a basic psychological need. When your social life feels like something that happened to you rather than something you built, that's a real deficit. even if the outcome looks fine from the outside.
Let's get practical for the second half of the prompt. Someone recognizes they've been in inheritance mode. They want to build their own friendships. Where do they start?
Step 1 is acknowledging that adult friendship formation is different from childhood or college friendship formation, and that's okay. You're not broken. The context changed.
The context being, you're not trapped in a dorm with 300 people your age, who are all also looking for friends.
So step 2 is identifying what I'd call an anchor activity. Something you genuinely want to do, that happens on a regular schedule, that involves other people. The key word is, don't join a running club if you hate running. Pick something you actually care about, because the enthusiasm will carry you through the awkward early phase.
The activity itself gives you something to talk about during the awkward early phase.
It's scaffolding. You're not just standing there trying to make conversation, you're doing something together, and the conversation grows out of that.
What about the time problem? The prompt mentioned having a family. There's a kid. 200 hours of friend time is a lot when you've got a spouse, a child, a job, and existing social obligations.
This is where the research gets real. I mentioned the 200 hours figure, but that's total contact, not concentrated time. An hour a week for 4 years is 200 hours. But it's also true that most people overestimate how much time they actually need to maintain friendships. There's a study from Jeffrey Hall at the University of Kansas that found even just catching up for a couple hours every few weeks is enough to maintain closeness once the friendship is established. The heavy investment is front-loaded.
The message is, front-load the time to get past the acquaintance barrier. Then it becomes more sustainable.
And the other thing is, combine activities where possible. If you're already spending Saturday morning at the park with your kid, invite another parent and their kid. You're not adding hours to your week. You're layering friendship, building onto existing time.
That's smart. What about the emotional side? I imagine someone who's been in inheritance mode for a while has probably internalized some stories about themselves. I'm not good at making friends. I'm an introvert, whatever.
This is where the research on friendship initiation gets really interesting. There's a series of studies led by Nicholas Epley at the University of Chicago looking at what happens when people are instructed to interact with strangers. Consistently, people report enjoying the interactions more than they predicted, and the strangers like them more than they expected. The barrier is almost entirely in the anticipation, not the experience.
The dread is lying to you.
The dread is lying. And the more people understand that, the easier it is to push through it. The liking gap I mentioned earlier, that's Epley's work. People walk away from conversations thinking, I was awkward, they probably didn't enjoy that, while the other person is thinking, that was nice, I liked them.
Which suggests that one practical piece of advice is, ignore your post-interaction analysis. It's probably wrong.
Statistically, it probably is. Your brain is running a negativity filter on your own social performance while giving everyone else a pass.
Let me ask about something the prompt touched on. The idea that couples shouldn't do everything together. What's the healthy ratio? Is there a number?
There's no magic ratio, and anyone who gives you one is making it up. But there is research on what predicts satisfaction, and it's less about the quantity of separate time and more about whether both partners feel free to have it. The perception of autonomy matters more than the hours.
It's not spend 3 nights a week apart. It's neither of you. Feels like asking for a night apart is a big deal.
And that's a cultural thing within the relationship. It's a norm you build. If every request for separate social time is met with, oh, okay, I guess, that's not autonomy.
Even if the partner says yes, the sigh before the yes is doing work.
The sigh is the message. And couples who navigate this well tend to have an explicit understanding that independent friendships are good for the relationship, not a threat to it. They've talked about it.
Maybe the advice is, have the meta conversation once, so you don't have to have the permission conversation every time.
That's beautifully put. One conversation about the principle, then the individual plans are just logistics.
What about the inherited friends themselves? If you're the inheriting partner, you might like these people. The issue isn't them. Can you transform inherited friends into your own friends?
You can, but it requires building one-on-one connections that exist independently of the couple context. If you've only ever seen these people as part of a group dinner with your partner present, the friendship is mediated. You need unmediated contact.
You text one of them separately and get coffee, without the partner.
And that can feel weird at first, especially if the friend was originally the partner's friend. But most people are receptive to it. Friendships are not zero-sum. The fact that someone was your partner's friend first doesn't mean they can't also be your friend independently.
Unless there's a weird loyalty dynamic.
That can happen. If the friendship predates the relationship by a long time, there might be a sense that the friend's primary loyalty is to the partner, but that usually only becomes an issue in conflict situations. In normal circumstances, most people are happy to have more friends.
The practical roadmap is anchor activity, regular schedule, be the initiator, ignore the dread, build unmediated contact with inherited friends where possible, and have the principal conversation with the partner exactly once.
That's the short version. I'd add one more thing from the research. Be patient with the timeline. Adult friendships often take 6 to 12 months to feel real. There's a period where you're still people who do the activity together rather than friends. That's normal. Don't bail at month 3 because it hasn't clicked yet.
The slow cooker model of friendship.
And for people who've been in inheritance mode, that waiting period is the hardest part because they're used to the instant social life that comes with the partner's network.
Inherited friends come pre-cooked. Making your own means sitting through the simmer.
The simmer is uncomfortable, but the outcome is something that belongs to you.
Let me ask about a tension I see in the prompt that we haven't addressed directly. The prompt says, I don't think this is a good dynamic, and couples need to have space and independent friends. But it also acknowledges that the inherited friends might be perfectly likable. So there's something here about the difference between a good outcome and a good process.
That's such an important distinction. You can end up with a perfectly nice social life through inheritance and still feel a lack of agency that matters. The process is part of the well-being, not just the outcome.
Because making a friend is an act of self-definition. You're saying, this person, this connection, this is me. When the friends are handed to you, you lose that reflective moment.
And I think that's why the prompt feels unsettled even though there's no obvious problem. The social life looks fine from the outside, but the person inside it knows they didn't build it.
It's like living in a furnished apartment. Everything works, but none of it is yours.
That's exactly the feeling. And the solution isn't to throw out the furniture, it's to add some pieces you chose yourself.
What about the partner's role in all this? If you're the one who brought the friend network, and your partner is feeling this inheritance unease, what should you do?
The research on this is less direct, but the clinical literature suggests a few things. First, don't take it personally. Your partner wanting independent friends is not a rejection of your friends or of you. Second, make it easy. If your partner is trying to build something separate, don't schedule over it. Don't make them feel guilty about it. Third, examine whether you've been contributing to the fused dynamic without realizing it.
What do you mean you're going without me? Reflex.
A lot of people don't even realize they're doing it. It's not malicious. It's just that the couple, as unit, has become the default and they've stopped noticing.
The partner who brought the network might need to actively create space, not just passively allow it.
And that can be as simple as saying, you should do that without me when an opportunity comes up, giving permission explicitly.
Because you can if you want, and I want you to, are different messages.
One implies tolerance, the other implies support.
Let's circle back to something you mentioned earlier, the 50 hours and 200 hours figures. Those are from Jeffrey Hall's work, right?
He published that in the Journal of Social and Personal Relationships. And what's interesting is that those numbers are averages. Some people click faster, some slower. The point isn't the exact number, it's that friendship has a time cost that most people underestimate.
In a world where everyone feels busy, that time cost is the real barrier.
But I'd argue that the time cost of not having your own friends is higher. It just shows up differently. Loneliness, relationship strain, loss of identity. Those are high costs paid over a long period.
The time argument is partly a prioritization argument in disguise.
I think so. People say they don't have time for friends, but they have time for Netflix. It's not a judgment. I watch plenty of television. But it's worth being honest about what's actually a time constraint and what's a priority choice.
What about the gender dimension? The prompt is from a man. Does the research show any differences in how men and women handle separate friendships and relationships?
There's a pretty robust finding that men, on average, have smaller social networks and are more likely to rely on their partner as their primary or sole confidant. There was a big survey a few years ago, I think it was the American Perspective Survey, that found something like 15% of men reported having no close friends, compared to about 10% of women.
Men are more at risk of the full merge dynamic.
And when the male partner is the one who moved into the female partner's social network, he might be even more likely to just accept the inheritance rather than build his own, because male friendship formation in adulthood is already harder.
The prompt mentioned being in Jerusalem. And there's a cultural layer here, too. Expat communities, religious communities, they often have ready-made social structures. You show up and there's a Shabbat dinner invitation before you've unpacked.
Which is wonderful in many ways, but it can also short-circuit the friendship-building process. You're absorbed into a social world immediately. You never experience the gap that forces you to build your own.
It's the social equivalent of being born rich. You never learn to earn.
And then, if something changes, the community shifts, you move again, the relationship ends, you're suddenly without the skills.
The advice we're giving isn't just for the current situation. It's an investment in future resilience.
Friendships you build yourself are portable in a way that inherited networks are not. If the relationship that brought you into the network ends, the friends who are primarily your partner's friends usually go with the partner.
Even if they like you.
Even if they like you. There's a loyalty gravity that pulls them back to the original connection.
That's a sobering thought. But it reinforces the whole argument for building something of your own.
And I want to be clear, this isn't about being paranoid or planning for the relationship to fail. It's about being a full person. Having your own friends is part of being a full person, whether you're in a relationship or not.
The prompt used the word subscribed, like signing up for a service. You don't choose the features, you just pay the fee and take what comes.
Unsubscribing from that model is hard, because it means opting out of convenience. The inherited social life is convenient. Everything is arranged. The calendar fills itself.
The first step is actually choosing inconvenience.
Saying no to some of the prearranged social life to create space for something you build yourself. That's a trade-off, and it might mean seeing less of people you like.
Which feels counterintuitive. You're stepping back from good people to go find other people who might also be good.
The difference is agency. And the research on well-being is consistent. Agency matters. Feeling like the author of your own life matters.
Let's talk about what happens when the partner doesn't get it. You try to build something separate, and they interpret it as pulling away.
That's a communication challenge. And the clinical advice is usually to frame it positively. Not, I need space from you, but I want to bring more energy into our relationship by having my own experiences. Connect it back to the relationship's health.
Which is actually true, according to the research you cited.
It is true. The Arizona study showed that independent friendships reduce relationship boredom. So you're not pulling away from the relationship, you're investing in its long-term vitality.
That's a much better framing than, I need space.
And if the partner still resists, that's information. That suggests a level of fusion or insecurity that might need its own attention.
What about the kid piece? The prompt mentioned a son. How does parenting affect this whole dynamic?
Parenting intensifies everything. It adds time pressure. It creates a whole new category of social obligation. Other parents, school events, playdates, and it often pushes couples further toward the fused model because coordinating separate social lives feels logistically impossible.
You end up doing everything as a family unit, and the separate friends project gets shelved indefinitely.
And that's understandable. But it also means that when the kids get older and need you less, you might look up and realize you haven't made a new friend in a decade.
The empty nest hits, and you don't know who you are socially.
So the advice is actually to protect some separate social time even during the intense parenting years, precisely because it's easy to let it slide.
Easier said than done with a young child.
But even one standing commitment, one evening a month, one Saturday morning activity, keeps the muscle from atrophying completely.
The practical advice for someone in the prompt's exact situation, married, kid, inherited social circle, feeling the lack of agency, is what? Give me the three-step version.
Step 1. Pick one thing that's yours. One activity, one group, one context that exists independently of your partner. Commit to it for 6 months minimum. Step 2. Initiate. Send the text. Make the invitation. Push through the dread. The data says people will respond more positively than you expect. Step 3. Build one-on-one connections with some of the inherited friends so they become real friendships rather than couple friendships. Coffee, not group dinner.
The step underneath all of that is, have the conversation with your partner about why this matters. Frame it as good for the relationship, and then just start doing it rather than endlessly negotiating.
That's it. Action over permission.
I want to go back to something you said about the liking gap. That people systematically underestimate how much others like them. Is that a universal finding?
It's remarkably robust. Epley's lab has replicated it across different contexts. Conversations between strangers, between acquaintances, in professional settings. The effect holds. People walk away from social interactions thinking they were more awkward and less liked than they actually were.
The voice in your head that says, "That was weird, they probably think I'm strange," is not a reliable narrator.
It's systematically unreliable. And knowing that doesn't make the voice go away, but it does give you a reason to ignore it.
That might be the single most useful piece of information in this entire episode. The dread is lying.
The dread is lying. Write that on a sticky note.
What about the role of technology? The prom didn't mention it, but a lot of friendship formation happens through apps and online communities now. Does the research say anything about whether digital-first friendships function differently?
The evidence is mixed, but the better studies suggest that online to offline friendships can be just as strong as friendships that start in person, provided they eventually move offline. The key variable is whether the friendship transitions to in-person contact at some point.
The app is a starting point, not the destination.
And for someone trying to build independent friendships, interest-based online communities can be a great way to find people who share specific passions. But you eventually need to meet them.
The modern version of the anchor activity. Instead of joining a bowling league, you join a Discord server and then organize a meetup.
Same principle, different medium.
One more thing I want to pull on. The prompt mentioned the feeling that all social matches have to be a collective thing. There's something there about the performative aspect of couple socializing that I think is under-discussed.
Say more about that.
When you socialize as a couple, you're not just being yourself. You're being yourself in relation to your partner. There's a performance, even if it's unconscious. You have shared stories, shared references, a shared presentation. The individual gets subsumed.
That's a really interesting point. And it connects to what sociologists call couple presentation of self, the way couples jointly manage impressions in social settings. It can be a very smooth performance, but it's still a performance.
If all your socializing is in that mode, you might start to lose track of what you like when you're not performing the couple.
That's the identity question again. Who are you when you're not someone's partner, someone's parent? Those roles are real and meaningful, but they're not the whole self.
Independent friendships aren't just about having fun without your partner. They're about maintaining contact with the self that exists outside the roles.
And that's why this matters even when the inherited friends are wonderful people and the relationship is solid. It's not about fixing something broken. It's about preserving something essential.
The prompt said, "I don't think couples should do everything together." That's the summary. And the research backs it.
The research backs it thoroughly. The healthiest relationships are two full people choosing to share a life, not two half people trying to become one.
That's a good place to land. One last question. For someone who's been in inheritance mode for years and is now trying to build independent friendships, how long should they expect it to take before it feels natural?
Based on the research, I'd say 6 to 12 months for the first real friendship to solidify and probably 2 years to build a small network that feels yours. It's a long game. But the alternative is waking up in 5 years with the same borrowed social life, or no social life at all if something changes.
Start now, be patient, ignore the dread, and remember that the awkward phase is a feature, not a bug.
The awkward phase is the price of admission.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the early medieval period, the region around Lake Chad was home to the Sao civilization, which produced elaborate terracotta figurines depicting ancestors and deities, some of the oldest surviving examples of sub-Saharan ceramic art outside the Nile Valley.
Not at all what I expected.
This has been my Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. Find us at My Weird Prompts. We're back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.